out here all over Africa.
And revolutionary.
AFDEF is an organization of the Uhuru movement that was built in 2007 in order to organize African doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, and other skilled Africans around the world to coordinate a variety of development projects that work to transform the miserable conditions of existence that have been imposed on our people around the world.
APST, UhuruRadio.com.
Uhuru Radio is developing a new programming schedule to include more music, cultural, educational, political, and multilingual programs from around the world. We are professionalizing the technical delivery of our programming, improving our sound quality and presentation. We are working to make our audio stream more accessible through mobile devices and distribution networks. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio, and the Burning Spear newspaper, the voice of the International African Revolution. We rely on your support.
We have on the phone a caller.
I don't understand, how is it okay and legal to bomb people on a daily basis all over the world, to starve people, and then when some airplanes fly into some towers, a guy gets off his medicine and starts shooting up the mall or something, then the world comes to an end.
Garvey's movement was a serious challenge to imperialism, because if Africans begin to work for our own interests, then we ain't working for theirs.
In the final analysis, white feminism just becomes, I don't know, a leftist feminist tool of colonial domination.
Mm. So this discussion has to happen.
This is Africa Live.
Raising up the question of African women in a way that contributes to our liberation and unification.
AFDEF sees our nursing school as an extension of what Marcus Garvey established in the early 1920s with the Black Cross nurses. Our nurses are being trained to not only again be nurses, but to be African internationals.
I sympathize with these people so much that I hope that as a consequence of what has happened to them, they will be able to look at the rest of the world as humans as well. They will be able to assume that the next victim of a drone attack in Afghanistan may also have parents, may also have community people who will suffer and cry for them as well.
This is Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. I'm Dedan Sankara. Today's show was actually produced for Sunday, March 2, 2014. It was not broadcast at that time because of technical difficulties. It was a special broadcast because of the death of Chokwe Lumumba on Tuesday, February 25, 2014. At the age of 66, Chokwe Lumumba was well into his sixth decade of an interesting life, a father, an activist, an attorney, and the founder of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, as well as the one-time vice president of the Republic of New Africa. And for the past 8 months, he was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. He died unexpectedly. Elected on a socialist agenda, Chokwe Lumumba's administration was promoting the establishment of worker-owned cooperatives and other forms of wealth creation based on the principles of solidarity, participatory democracy, and economic and social equity. On Thursday, February 27th, for our regular segment, This Moment in History, I interviewed Chairman Omala Yeshitela of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party on Chokwe Lumumba, the Republic of New Africa, the theory of the Black Belt, and the historical relationship between their organizations, the use of electoral politics by revolutionary organizations, and the history of imperialist murder of African leadership throughout the world. It's clear from the interview that regardless of the philosophical differences between Chokwe Lumumba and Chairman Omala Yeshitela, there was a relationship of solidarity and respect. The differences were always put forth in principled struggles to sharpen their attacks against our colonial condition and imperialism. On Saturday, March 8th, Chokwe Lumumba, a general, was laid to rest. Rather than allow our heads and spirits to remain bowed in sorrow, we must stand a little taller, work harder, and raise our fists and unite with the proclamation to free the land. And now more than ever, we must join the African liberation struggle through revolutionary organizations so that African people everywhere will have freedom within our lifetime. Comrade Chokwe Lumumba, we will look for you in the world with Uhuru. The Jackson Rising Conference will take place May 2nd through May 4th, 2014 in Jackson, Mississippi. Africa Live returns after this musical tribute to Chokwe Lumumba. a selection from Roy Ayers' 1973 album, Ubiquity. The cut? Red, Black, and Green. Welcome back to Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. Africa Live brings you the best in news and analysis from the African internationalist perspective. I'm Dedan Sankara. This segment of the show is entitled, This Moment in History, an Analysis of Current Events. Our guest this week is Chairman Omalla Yesitela of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party. This week, we're talking about the recent death of Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, and the events unfolding in Venezuela. Uhuru Chairman, and welcome to Africa Live. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
Chairman, I know that you've known Chokwe Lumumba for quite some time. He was a speaker at the 5th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party in 2010, and most recently sent a statement of solidarity as the mayor of the city of Jackson, Mississippi, to the 6th Congress of the African People's Socialist Party that took place in December of 2013. Please share with us your thoughts on hearing of the death of Chokwe Lumumba.
Chokwe was one of the few remaining stalwarts of the African liberation movement in this country. We've had serious struggles, political and ideological struggles at different times, but we had, I believe, real respect for each other, notwithstanding the line differences. The thing that was striking about Chokwe is the fact that he was not simply one about the liberation of African people, but he was clear that liberation had to mean self-determination, self-government, that we had to have our own capacity for governing ourselves, that the fundamental contradiction that we were confronted with stemmed from the fact that we were not a self-governing people. And that was the primary basis of the unity that we had. And it was also a unity that was reinforced by the fact that Chokwe was not just someone who had certain beliefs, but he acted them out in the world. He was at one juncture, like his earlier political life revolved around his participation in what was called the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. Most people knew of it and perhaps know of it today as the Republic of New Africa, which was an organization that presumed itself to be the governing body for African people in this country, whom it had considered to be New African. And it saw 5 states in the U.S. South as being the national territory, national homeland of Africans in this country. And Chokwe is someone who always acted according to his belief. He was, on occasion, had to suffer seriously violent armed attack by the FBI and different police organizations. And then he became a lawyer, and he defended some of the most important forces, political forces, in our struggle. He was a really important force, and when he became mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, it provided an opportunity, he thought, for him to try and implement some kinds of progressive politic, and I'm assuming that would have allowed to establish the kind of base in Mississippi and for the independence struggle that he was so much a part of. So Chokwe was a really very important figure, important force. As you may know, he participated last with us, was in November in Washington, D.C., at the Black is Back mobilization that we did there. But yeah, we'll miss Chokwe. It was a real surprise to learn of his death, and I knew that he had had some health issues in the recent past, but had no idea that there was any life-threatening problems that he suffered from, and still don't know the details of what it is that he was supposed to have died of. But he was an important force, and he would certainly be missed.
Can you tell us the history of your relationship with Chokwe Lumumba?
My dealing with Chokwe had nothing to do with the fact that he was a lawyer. It had to do more with his participation in the political arena, direct participation in the political arena. I'm not suggesting that one cannot participate in the political arena as a lawyer, in that capacity as a lawyer, because clearly he did that. And some of the cases that he dealt with, I don't consider the case of Tupac, for example, one of those cases, but he did defend Asada, he did defend other kinds of revolutionary forces. And so, obviously, that was something that occurred within the national liberation struggle. But that's not how I knew him. I knew him as a young person before he even became a lawyer. I think the first time I met Chokwe, he was with Imari Obadeli, and I met him here in the city of St. Petersburg, Florida. Must have been the late 60s that I met him. He was just a youngster who was traveling with Imari Obadeli, who was then the president of the Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa. And I've known him subsequently throughout the years, during the times when the party had organized the African National Reparations Organization specifically, and we were doing these tribunals, holding tribunals, putting imperialism on trials to try to help African people recognize the validity of the reparations demand, and trying to not only help African people recognize that, but also demonstrating quite clearly, empirically, the damage done to African people not just through slavery, but subsequent to slavery, looking at the treatment and conditions of African people throughout this country. So for 12 years or so straight, we held these tribunals, and Chokwe at different times would come and testify at these tribunals. So that was one way that we knew him. We knew him also because at some juncture, there was a kind of peeling off from certain components of the Republic of New Africa, and Chokwe initiated the development of the New African People's Organization, NAPO or NAPO, as it was called. And there were different times where we organized various kinds of activities, actions, demonstrations, mobilizations, conferences, etc., that NAPO, NAPO, I think, as most of them called it, participated in. And so it was like in these political arenas that I knew Chokwe mostly. Now, we had a serious struggle because at one time we actually ended up publishing a book based on the polemics that came out of that struggle, where a sector, the then president of the Republic of New Africa, was actually engaged in leading mobilizations that were united with the police departments in talking about taking our communities back during the crack question. And so we had these serious kinds of struggles, because at that time there were many people who did not understand that crack was something that was imposed on our community by the government, that it was part of counterinsurgency, and that it was something that was used to justify the ongoing attack on the most vulnerable sector of the African community, which was the working class. At first, the drugs themselves was a part of the attack, and then the government response to the drugs that it put there was a part of the attack, and that our responsibility was to identify the real opponent, the real enemy, which was the U.S. government that was putting that stuff there and using it to wreak havoc in our communities, and that our real responsibility was to defend the African working class that was being victimized on both ends. When I say both ends, I mean as the recipients of the drugs being put there, the drug economy being imposed on our community, and as the recipients of the violence that's led to, up to now, more than 1 million African people being locked up in prisons in this country. I mean, all of that stemmed from that same kind of contradiction. So we had serious polemics that we initiated at forces who were involved in that, and particularly at the so-called New African Movement that was the main proponent of that position at the time. And so there were different political struggles that we had, serious ideological struggles that we had. And also we had the struggle because for the longest period of time, the people who engaged in the five-state position did not distinguish themselves ideologically from capitalists and socialists and what have you. And so we engaged in a struggle with them that finally pushed them to declare themselves to be socialists and at least nominally opposed to capitalism. So those were some of the differences that we had, but also this was the context with which I knew Chokwe. I knew him, that I felt like we at different times, you know, were contending, but we were contending within a common trajectory toward independence of African people from the control of the U.S. And any other kind of external power.
Chairman, you've said that the Republic of New Africa and the African People's Socialist Party were in the same struggle for African liberation. Let's talk about the history of the Republic of New Africa and the theory of the Black Belt and how that diverges from the philosophy of African internationalism.
Well, it started in Detroit. The founding conference was held. And in Detroit, there were, among others, a couple of brothers whose last name was Hedley. It was Milton. I've forgotten the name of the other brother, the slave or traditional colonial name, but it became Imari Obadeli. And as I mentioned, they had this conference and several hundred people attended it in Detroit, and they consolidated what they characterized as Republic of New Africa. And they were influenced a lot by Malcolm X, certainly who had been brought at different, while he was alive, into Detroit by some of the same people who were to speak. He had been brought to speak in Detroit by some of the same people who were involved in organizing the Republic of New Africa. And again, as I mentioned, the Republic of New Africa made the assumption that our experience in the so-called Black Belt South had created this new African. And this was something that was informed by the Black Belt South theory that had come from the Communist Party in 1928, following the success that they and others had in destroying the movement of Marcus Garvey. But instead of just the general theory of a black belt South, they came up with the notion that there were five specific states in the U.S. South that included Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana. This was specific areas that had, there was contiguous land mass that had a lot of African people, a concentration of African people there, and it facilitated the idea of actually being able to put together a program of struggle that could capture these territories as a new African nation, if you will. And of course, we had differences with the Republic of New Africa. We had differences in terms of where the national homeland of African people really is, or the question of whether or not we were new Africans, had been transformed into some other entity than the same Africans who were brought here some years ago. We had differences based on the fact that crimes that have been committed against indigenous peoples here, the central to all of them, next to the near genocide that had been imposed on that population, was the theft and occupation of their land. And the fact that even as we're having this discussion now, there are these concentrations camps referred to as Indian reservations, where many of the remainder of the indigenous population are located to trap in the worst kinds of conditions. And we felt like any effort to claim this land as our own would contribute to the struggle and the oppression, the attack on the indigenous peoples here who still have no rights, no resources, and again trapped in these concentration camps. So that's one issue that we had with it, that it is uniting with the same kind, we felt, of politic that whites were able to use and take Palestine, claiming that Palestine was there, renaming it Israel, and that whites had used to go into South Africa and claim that land and say that since they had been there for and made some improvements on the land that they were now Africans, and the African people were not even Africans anymore. So we felt like that was born of the same kind of faulty analysis and was extremely problematic and placed us on the side of reaction as opposed to on the side of revolution. That it was clear to us that Africa is the national homeland of African people and that Africa is central to our future, which does not mean that African people outside of Africa, whether that's in the United States or whether that's in the Caribbean or whether that's even throughout Europe and various other places, it doesn't mean that African people in these different places do not have the basis for struggle, but it does mean that central to the struggle is recognition that just as the land of the indigenous people is critical to their own identity and to their oppressive conditions, then the land of African people, which is Africa, is a fundamental question. And that no matter what our conditions happen to be, any place outside of Africa, these conditions owe themselves to the fact that Africa was assaulted by Europe as a part of a process of building Europe, building the European nation, building capitalism itself. And therefore, to have a genuine response to our conditions, it presupposed the need of black people everywhere recognizing that and struggling for the emancipation and unification of our national homeland. The other thing about that is that if you start picking apart the struggle of African people or the conditions of African people wherever we are located, the specific places where we are located, as the basis for our struggle, then what you end up doing is isolating the struggle of African people in one place from the struggle of African people in all the other places. And what we're saying is that whether we're in Haiti, whether we're in Jamaica, whether we are in Somalia or in Houston, Texas, that the basis of our oppression and the conditions stem from the fact that somebody came to Africa, our national homeland, attacked Africa, and even up to now hold it under indirect neo-colonial rule and authority for the purpose of extracting all kinds of value there, and they have dispersed us to all these other places. So Africa has been taken away from Africans. The conditions that we suffer in the various places are due to that fact and that we have been dispersed. So our national homeland has been under assault, our national identity has been under assault, and all of the resources that ought to belong to us go now to serve other entities, particularly Europe and America, but increasingly others, at our expense. So we believe that the best approach to this question is one that recognizes the fundamental universal contradiction that we suffer from, and that will give us the benefit of unity of all African people everywhere engaged in, consciously engaged in the same struggle as was Marcus Garvey was able to do earlier in the first quarter of the 20th century. Well, the basis of our unity of the Republic of New Africa, Chokwe and other people who held the view, was the fact that despite the differences in terms of the long view, we were all united around the fact that America was a hostile entity that had imposed its will on African people and for the purpose of extracting value. And we lived as an oppressed population, and that the struggle for self-determination was a critical and fundamental struggle. So that is the basis of our unity, that we unite with the Republic of New Africa. We unite with those people who talk about five states around the fact that the struggle for self-determination is what we ought to be involved in. The difference is that we don't think that, first of all, that this five-state question or just self-determination in the United States in and of itself is enough, that it doesn't go far enough. It cannot solve the fundamental contradictions, but we unite with everybody who can agree with the fact that African people are engaged in the struggle for self-determination. It is our responsibility as a party and as an international movement to build revolutionary movements, organization, various places around the world that would allow us to have to take a revolution to its completion. And its completion will mean the liberation and unification of Africa under the leadership of the African working class. And just as today, the conditions of existence of African people around the world stem from the conditions of existence in Africa as a whole continent held under neo-colonial domination, the existence of African people around the world, whether it's in the United States or the various other places, will be severely impacted in a very positive way by the conditions in Africa once it is liberated. Africa becomes the power that is able to extend our freedom every place else in the world.
Chairman, let's talk about why would a revolutionary enter the realm of electoral politics within the imperialist system?
I can't say so much why a revolutionary would do that. I can say that I assume that Chokwe did that in Mississippi, because the Republic of New Africa and the politic that informed this action, again, made the assumption of there being five states in the U.S. South that constitute the national homeland or national territory of African people. And so several of people who were associated with the Republic of New Africa, who thought of themselves as what they characterized as New Africans, did migrate to the South, and Chokwe was one who went back into Mississippi. And I think that he had concluded that the electoral path, capturing electoral power, would be a means by which he could facilitate this struggle for independence in the South, that somehow there can be an accumulation of power organized initially and certainly immediately around the electoral process that could somehow be transformed the situation to win actual power that could contribute to an independence movement there. So I'm assuming that that is what his struggle to become mayor was all about. They tried to initiate what was called a Jackson Plan, which presupposed a new collective kind of economics that they would try to implement and various other kinds of things. And he was actually actively trying to recruit Africans to come back to the South and come into Mississippi from his position as mayor of Jackson. So that had to do with what it was he was trying to do. I think that he saw this as a really important effort to facilitate a strategy that would bring Africans into active political life, and immediately organized around his being mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, that could be used to actually win independence for what they characterize as a national homeland in the South.
You're listening to Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. This segment is entitled, This Moment in History. Our guest today is Chairman Omalla Yesitela of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party. We're speaking on the recent death of Chokwe Lumumba. Chairman, what are your thoughts on the possibility of a continuance of the progressive strategy that Mayor Chokwe Lumumba started in Jackson, Mississippi?
I'm hoping that the election, the entry into electoral politics, was something that was bigger than Comrade Chokwe, that it was a response to some kind of strategic objective of the revolutionary organization that he represented. I'm hoping that his entry into electoral politics was based on decisions made by a revolutionary organization that had certain long-term goals and objectives in mind. And because otherwise, even if Comrade Chokwe were holding on to revolutionary principles, the ability for him to do anything is going to be extremely limited. And even if he were effective, it would only be effective for the duration of his position as mayor. And so for me, running for mayor should have been something that was facilitating a greater agenda, revolutionary agenda, that was a response to a program, tactics and strategies that had been worked out by a revolutionary organization. And this is one of the interesting things, because especially with the election of Barack Hussein Obama, or selection, I should say, as U.S. president, there are more and more African people everywhere who see the electoral process as the means by which we can capture some kind of power, which is, in many ways, goes back to a kind of pre-black power, pre-revolutionary anti-imperialist movement in this country, when the electoral arena was seen as the principal way to achieve power. Now we have the example of Chokwe. We have had the example of Charles Barron, who is on the city council of in New York and has done some pretty progressive things and used that his position there to make some really important kinds of statements. And we have in Newark, Ras Baraka, who's also running for office. But the critical question still remains for me, and I believe from the perspective of the African People's Socialist Party, is what connections do these campaigns and these elections have to revolutionary organization and some kind of revolutionary strategy? We saw at one juncture in Chicago when Harold Washington was elected mayor in that city, which was a big thing, and people were extraordinarily excited, and he appeared to be a relatively progressive person. But with his death, there was no movement, no revolutionary organization, anything. And in fact, now in Chicago, you know, we see Rahm Emanuel, who was right out of Barack Obama's office and who has his own history of reactionary politics, is the mayor, and schools are being closed and under his leadership and all kinds of other horrible things. In many ways, if we're going to enter into electoral politics, our entry should be, in many ways, a criticism of the electoral process as it exists, for its inability to serve the interests of African people, and therefore we are here as a part of a process of remedying that. We go into the electoral process for the purpose of bringing our people out of it, of the electoral process as the only means of doing things, and to enhance the power of the people as opposed to the office of the colonial power. And that has to be the objective of running for office. That has to be the objective of capturing power. Our struggle for power in that process has to be for the purpose of eroding the power of the colonial state and transferring that power to the people through its revolutionary organization. Certainly that's what we would be involved in doing as the African People's Socialist Party. And so I think this question of electoral politics is extremely important, because I don't think that it is an arena that revolutionaries can afford to ignore. I think that we have to assume the responsibility of fighting on every front to not allow the African petty bourgeoisie or the bourgeoisie to be able to struggle for power in that arena without having to contend with the ideas and the presence of the African revolution. So I think that is appropriate. especially when you take the fact that the majority of African people who participate in politics in this country do it through the electoral process. I think 25% of the Democratic Party is comprised of African people. They are not part of the African People's Socialist Party. They are not a part of the Uhuru movement. They're with the Democratic Party. So it is appropriate for us to struggle to try to bring the people out of there into their own power, their own party, etc. But we have to always keep in mind that our objective is to undermine, to impact the ability of the Democratic Party, of the colonial power itself to govern and have authority over our people. We have to take this as a means by which we would transfer the power to the people and away from the colonial state and any other organization under its control. African who wanted to express solidarity with the struggle of oppressed people who would recognize what was happening in Venezuela as a direct attack on the Bolivarian movement that came about to end the suffering and to put the power in the hands of the people. That revolutionary mayor would do that. And I think Chokwe would have done that if he were not the mayor, but the fact that he is the mayor is something that he wants to use. He's using that as a means of trying to extend and promote solidarity beyond just what would be coming from him as an individual or a revolutionary organization that would not have the same kind of influence. So I think it's a very important thing that Chokwe did, sending that letter, and to the extent he was able to win the city council to accepting that solidarity statement. I think it's very powerful, and I think it's an example of what Chokwe was trying to do with the office of the mayor. And I think that's really important, because many people who are expressing sympathy and condolence for the death of this comrade are doing so because he was the mayor. They are saying, the mayor, you know, our comrade, the mayor. I'm talking about people inside this country. I'm talking about Africans. But the mistake that Africans and others would make in dealing with Chokwe is to assume that it is office of the mayor that define who Chokwe is, as opposed to the fact that it was Chokwe Lumumba, the revolutionary, who defined what the office of the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, would be. So our condolence is not to the mayor of Jackson so much as it is to comrade Chokwe, who was a revolutionary soldier who was in the trenches with the rest of us. Chokwe also, from the office of the mayor, sent a solidarity statement to of the 6th Congress of our party, which will be published in May. So he used that office as an instrument, to the extent that he was capable of doing it, as an instrument to promote solidarity and with the revolutionary struggle inside this country and other places around the world. His participation in the 5th Congress was really important. This, of course, was before he was mayor. This is 2010. The thing is that he came to provide solidarity to the Congress, which he did. And the other thing is that we wanted to have a really important discussion on the issue of land and a national question. This is a continuation of struggle that I mentioned we had had with Chokwe and the five-state position over many, many years. And so part of Chokwe's participation was on a panel, the majority of whom participants supported one way or another the five-state position of Chokwe, and we felt like it was important because we wanted to air that discussion. We think it's important for that discussion to be out in the open, and we live at a time now where most people don't even know that there has ever been an issue of this kind of struggle. They just assume that we're Americans and we're trying to be free, etc. So we reintroduced that question at the Congress, and to allow the different perspectives around this question to be discussed and examined. And Chokwe was one of the proponents and of the five-state pro-independence position, along with Comrade Saladin Muhammad from the Black Workers for Justice out of North Carolina, and the comrade who was then the chair of the New Black Panther Party, Malik Shabazz. They held the position around the Black Belt or the New African question. They were sort of united, generally speaking, there. And, of course, the party has an entirely different view on that. So Chokwe was there and for that Congress to provide solidarity and to participate in that panel.
Chairman, you've long spoken of the ongoing treacherous history of the imperialist in the assassination of the leadership of the African liberation struggle throughout the world. It's been used as a means to remove those that would overturn and end the exploitative relationships between oppressed people and imperialism. Another aspect of assassination is that it's used to leverage the highest level of demoralization within the African community. As you point out, the colonial mandate is to make it clear to African people that the price of being a revolutionary is death. Chokwe had been the mayor of Jackson for a mere 8 months. He had the support of city residents, city workers, and he had successfully brought forth a tax measure to fund the improvement of the decayed infrastructure of Jackson, Mississippi. Then with the proposed Jackson Rising Conference, the Lumumba administration was to take on the development of industry and employment through a series of worker-owned and operated cooperatives. Events that were happening in Jackson all point to the emergence of the upsetting of the status quo. Chairman, what are your thoughts when you hear that many people believe that Chokwe Lumumba was assassinated?
Well, I think that any reasonable African or revolutionary any place on earth should look with serious suspicion at the death of Comrade Chokwe. And I think that when you clearly in part because of the kinds of things he was trying to introduce in Jackson, from his position as mayor, this incredible history that he has. In fact, he survived shootouts and things like that with the FBI, and they know that. In fact, an aspect of it became a part of a campaign against him, the propaganda put out against him when he was running for mayor. So, I know that Chokwe had some health issues. But the fact is that the existence of the health issues could be something that the state would rely on to cover any attempt to kill someone like Chokwe. I think that is absolutely right to be suspicious. Now, at this point, we don't know that much about the death. There are various rumors that are circulating about how he went to the hospital and how he was feeling. And then, of course, as we mentioned, there's a knowledge of the history, the struggle he had with prostate cancer some years ago. But the world is on fire. Every place that you look in the world, you see incredible struggle. On virtually every continent, people are struggling to change their relationship with empire, with imperialism. And this country right now is engaged, not just this country, but this country in concert with various traditional imperialist powers, is engaged in doing everything it can to push back all of the manifestations, all of the things that are contributing to destroying this system, from what they are doing in Venezuela at this moment to try to push that back, something that we anticipated in the political report to the 6th Congress. The activity that they engaged in Ukraine to push the guns of imperialism right to the door of Russia, that it is manifesting itself as contention with the not with capitalism or imperialism, but with the order of things as they are in its own selfish interest. Almost every place you look, you can see this desperate attack by the imperialists to push back the whole revolutionary process. The thousands of people that the United States government is participating in killing in Syria. The thousands of people who have died and been made homeless in Libya. The thousands of people who are kept in the worst kinds of circumstances right now using AFRICOM to maintain the status quo in Africa. I mean, it's bloodshed. Look at what the United States is doing right here in the United States in terms of the kinds of laws that are being used to justify controlling African people, putting whole communities where families live off limits to other people in the community using various kinds of laws and things like that. And so, there's no doubt in my mind that the ruling class here and around the world anticipate having to fight in this country, that the revolutionary or the movement for independence, the movement to change our relationship, starvation and poverty imposed on us by the United States, that this movement is going to manifest itself very sharply here in the United States. They know that's going to happen because it's happened before. And who has always led this movement except the African people in this country? I think one should be extremely suspicious about Chokwe's death, especially given the fact the things he was trying to do in his history, unlike Mayor Washington even, unlike some other forces who may be or may not be progressive. I think we should even be suspicious of the death of Amiri Baraka, who was 79, but he just went to the hospital for some relatively minor procedure, and then he never leaves the hospital alive. And the thing that's striking about this, that must be recognized, is that in the 1960s, what we had when the revolution reached its height in this country, African people had no veterans that we could go to, revolutionary veterans, for any kind of leadership, for any kind of direction, for any kind of assistance in terms of making revolution. Now, what we see, I mean, it was all on-the-job training. I mean, Stokely Carmichael meeting with Fidel Castro in his 20s. Huey P. Newton meeting with the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party and Revolution in his 20s. Eldridge Cleaver meeting the leadership of the revolutionary process in Algeria in his 20s. So this is how things were in the 1960s, on-the-job training. Now, there are revolutionary veterans who exist who can participate and provide some kind of leadership. And now what seems to be happening is that you see people like Amiri Baraka, and we had differences with Baraka, but the thing is that he had been around long enough, and our movements in the past that never were allowed to exist long enough to acquire political maturity, to acquire experience, and Baraka had been around, Chokwe had been around, and there are various other people who have been around. Just think about it. The lifespan of the Black Panther Party, I'm talking about the revolutionary lifespan, was no more than 3 years, because the government has not allowed, generally speaking, for revolutionary organizations to survive long enough to acquire experience, long enough to acquire a certain kind of political maturity. And Chokwe and Amiri Baraka and other people like that represent experience and a certain kind of political maturity, and despite the fact that we think they were ideologically off-center, but we think that this government would have been concerned with them, just as it's probably concerned with us. I mean, we've been around for 41 years, engaged in revolutionary struggle, revolutionary activity. So, yeah, I think that we have to be suspicious of the death of Chokwe Lumumba, again, specifically because of the kinds of things that he was trying to make happen in Jackson, but also recognizing, contextualizing that with how things are unfolding in the world, a whole crisis of this imperialist system at a time where that's pushing people to look for alternatives, look for different kinds of answers. So it would not surprise me if they killed Chokwe. We know they have the capacity to do that. We know they can kill people and simulate things like heart attacks and cancers and et cetera, because they've done that, we are familiar with. So, yeah, I think we should be suspicious.
Chairman, let's turn our attention to Venezuela. We've seen the images in the imperialist media of people rioting in the streets, people being shot by soldiers, as well as we've heard from the imperialist pundits, which speak to the lack of support and legitimacy of the presidency of Maduro. What is going on in Venezuela?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to understand that among the things that's occurring in Venezuela is the U.S. government is involved, especially since the death of Hugo Chavez, has escalated all efforts destabilizing that country so that it could initiate what it euphemistically refers to as regime change, to get puppet regime in power. And so that's what's going on. It has impacted on the economy of Venezuela by manipulating the amount of resources that can get there, contributing to inflation and things like that in the country. And it has been supporting for a period of time, which is one of the reasons that Hugo Chavez had other times kicked out U.S. forces in Venezuela, because it has funded, it has given millions of dollars to so-called opposition groups to contribute to their ability to challenge the peace and the ability of the people of Venezuela to have access to their own resources. And so they have people in the streets, the U.S. government, because we talk about things like soldiers shooting people. For sure, I don't think you can say that the soldiers are shooting people. We know that people are being shot. We know that there's an effort being made to destabilize the country. We know that the U.S. government, again, has funded the so-called opposition. And this one entity, Leopoldo Lopez, you know, which is a white man, and you have the situation where there's been a kind of hierarchy. The ruling elite there have been white people, just like in various other places, and they are being displaced in terms of the growing power of the people that's come about as a consequence of Chavez. You know, in Venezuela, even though the economy is bad and troubled on the one hand, on the other hand, we've seen a rapid attack on this huge gap between the rich and the poor, where the poor are much better now under the Bolivarian government than it was under the previous government that was supported by the United States. I think it's important to know that the Venezuelan government, the existing Venezuelan government, is there because of an election. People, they won an election. And this is despite all the efforts being made by the United States and other powers to support and give resources to what they characterize as the opposition. So what we have in Venezuela is clearly an attempt to destabilize the country, to create obvious a kind of atmosphere supported by the media of the imperialist countries, specifically the United States and other European powers, and whatever lack is that the United States has in the Americas, to create the sense that things are so destabilized and the government is so ruthless that anything that happens to overturn this government is legitimate. Listen, in the political report to the 6th Congress, I wrote about shifting the balance of power in the world so that people and throughout the Americas, throughout Asia and the Middle East and various other places, the driving historical forces, and they are overturning relationships they have with imperial powers. And then in the political report we say, however, the full measure of the shifting balance of geopolitical power cannot be fully understood without considering other areas of the world where U.S. imperialism is experiencing a tuck-tail retreat. In South America, the advent of the government of the late Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, as well as the governments of Evo Morales of Bolivia and Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, is representative of dwindling U.S. influence on that continent, derisively considered the U.S. backyard in the past. The death of Hugo Chavez in March of 2013 will not change that reality. Proven to have been an extremely important figure in the development of the struggles against imperialism, Chavez was representative of the sea change occurring in the world. This is something the U.S. and other imperialists are attempting to accept or to defend against. There is currently an escalation of intrigue and interference in the political situation in Venezuela and the region, with the intent to intensify political and social instability that will support and justify U.S. efforts to isolate the Venezuelan government and replace it with a puppet regime. This represents a typical imperialist misunderstanding, reflecting an inability and unwillingness to see the generalized historical trend manifested in specific events. This was written for our Congress that happened in December. And now we see the unfolding of the very same things that, you know, we predicted the United States government would do. So we're not surprised at all about this. If anything, right now I'm concerned because the political situation and development in that region may serve to some extent to be an impediment to what I know should happen. And what should happen in Venezuela is that the Bolivarian government should crush those forces who are trying to take Venezuela back to the past, where the majority of the poor people would not have the benefit of the 20,000 or more Cuban doctors who are providing free health care, where the majority of the people would not have the benefit of the changing economics on the ground that's closing the wealth gap between the rich and the poor, that the majority of the people in Venezuela, poor people, would not be able to anticipate a decent future. I think that it would be important that reactionary opposition needs to be crushed, and there needs to be the initiation of a genuine dictatorship of the Venezuelan working class. That, in my view, would be the ideal thing. I can't read well enough all of the conditions on the ground in Venezuela from here. And I know that part of the limitations of what the Venezuelan government perceives itself being able to do is based on what the political terrain in South America happens to be at this time, and various other kinds of things happening in the world. But it seems to me that what needs to happen in Venezuela is an end to any kind of vacillation or any attempt to try and appease these forces of reaction or the United States government itself. Because there's never going to be any real appeasement. They're never going to stop attempting to overturn that government and that project, the Bolivarian project, that is designed to uplift the conditions of the working masses. And of course, that can only come at the expense of this entrenched, reactionary, mostly white, elite force. Like Leopoldo Lopez, the guy who's one of the leaders of the so-called opposition, this is a Harvard graduate. It comes from a very elite white family. You will find most of the opposition, so-called opposition, concentrated among this previously powerful elite sector of the Venezuelan government that trembles at the very thought that the poor and working people in Venezuela would be able to have a future, because that future can only come at the expense of those who are stealing all the resources and shoveling it out to the U.S. government.
You're listening to Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. In this segment entitled This Moment in History, our guest today has been Chairman Omala Yeshitela of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party. We've been speaking on the recent death of Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, and the recent events in Venezuela. Chairman, thank you for joining us today here on Africa Live.
Thank you. It's always good to be here and to speak to your audience, to speak to the members of the party, the Uhuru movement, and everybody else that tunes in to this remarkable Uhuru Radio. Thank you very much, Uhuru.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
It's now time to order your signed copy of Omali Yeshitela's new book, The Uneasy Equilibrium, The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. Chairman Omali's groundbreaking political analysis shows the way forward for people looking for answers during this period of crisis for imperialism, a crisis that offers great opportunity for colonized peoples everywhere. This latest book by the founder and leader of the African Socialist International and the Uhuru Movement costs $29.99 and will come off the press this spring. Order now at burningspearmarketplace.com or by calling 727-824-5700 and your copy will be personally signed by the author. Call 727-824-5700 or visit burningspearmarketplace.com today to pre-order your commemorative signed copy of The Uneasy Equilibrium, The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. Uhuru means freedom.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
If one would open up such truth as the truth of God to the people, I do think that he's within his right to stay out of the sight of the people until he has won everything to himself, as the Bible referred for us to it like this, that he's something like a king looking for a kingdom, and that he go and he visit the people, and then he leaves the people and goes away and wait until the time when that he can secure the kingdom. Then he returns to the people that he had made himself manifest. So I think that is a pretty good answer.
Well, I can do anything without consulting my crystal. Let's go inside here. We'll just come along, I'll show you. That's right here. Sit right down here. That's it. This is the same genuine, magic, authentic crystal used by the priests of Isis and Osiris in the days of the pharaohs of Egypt, in which Cleopatra first saw the approach of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony and so on. Now, you'd better close your eyes, my child, for a moment in order to be better in tune with the infinite.
It's frustrating when you just can't express yourself. And it's hard to trust enough to undress yourself. Stand exposed and naked in a world full of hatred, where the sick thoughts of mankind control all the sacred. I pause, take a step back, record all the setbacks, and fast forward towards the stars in the jetpack. My feet might fail me, my heart might ail me, the synagogues of Satan might accuse and jail me, strip crown nail me, brimstone hail me. They might defeat the flesh, but they could never ever kill me. They might fulfill the music, but could never ever fill me. To the lawyers, to the sheriffs, to the judges, to the debt holders and lawmakers, up and sue me, bill me. That name on that birth certificate, that ain't the real me. The lies can't conceal me. The sunrise and the moon tides and the sky's gonna reveal me. My brain pours water out, my tear ducts to heal me. My Lord's too beneficent. The message grab a hold to every ear it get whispered in. The waters in the bayous of New Orleans still glistening. The universe is listening. Be careful what you say in it. My grandma told me every bed in the make, he lay in it. The church you go to pray in it. Work is on the outside. Staring out the windows is for love songs and house flies.
Ooh, I got something to say. Ooh, I got something to say. Yesterday is gone. Tomorrow. Get it right.
tomorrow is on the way.
Welcome back to Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. We started the musical set with Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. Released in 1964, it's considered a seminal song of the civil rights movement and listed as one of the greatest songs of all time. We follow that with a new release by J Electronica, Better in Tune with the Infinite, featuring LaTanya Givens. In honor of Women's History Month, we'll hear from Fannie Lou Hamer, a member of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, speaking to the Credentials Committee of the Democratic National Convention, August 22, 1964, in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
With me is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a member of the Executive Committee of the Freedom Democratic Party and a candidate of that party for the United States Congress. Mrs. Hamer, tell us a little about yourself, what part of the South you come from, and how you got involved in Freedom Democratic Party politics.
Thank you very much. My home is in Roosevelt, Mississippi. It's located in the Black Belt of Mississippi, known as the Delta area. And actually, the way I got involved in the Freedom Democrat Party is we tried to get in the regular Democrat Party. We tried from the precinct level up to the county and from the county to the state. I remember when we tried to attend the precinct meeting at the little polling place in Roosevelt, it was eight of us, eight Negroes, went up to visit the precinct meeting, and the door was locked, and we couldn't get in, and we stood on the outside and held our own meeting. We elected our chairman and our secretary, our delegates and our alternates, and we passed the law to resolution. And we moved from the precinct level on through the county and up to the state. The 24th of April in 1964, we organized at the Masonic Temple in Jackson, Mississippi, the Mississippi Freedom Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. And then the 24th of August in 1964, we went to the National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, to challenge the seating of the regular delegation from Mississippi. Mm-hmm.
In which you were unsuccessful.
That's right. We was offered two votes at large as a compromise.
In the convention.
In the convention. Mm-hmm. But after 100 years, we wouldn't accept a compromise because 63,000 people at that time was registered with the Freedom Democrat Party, so we didn't compromise. So again, in January, beginning the 4th of January, the three candidates from the Freedom Democrat Party, Mrs. Gray, Mrs. Devine, and I went up before the door of the House of Representatives to contest the seating of the five representatives from Mississippi, and we was turned away. We didn't go there to be seated because we knew from the beginning that we wouldn't be seated, but we wanted to explain our side. Whereas in a state that 42% of the people can't register, they wasn't representing us. And I think somebody, it's time now for somebody to be in Congress that's going to represent the people of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And we wasn't allowed to go inside, but that didn't stop the challenge. We did have that day 149 congressmen that stood up against these people being seated. So we are still working with this challenge. And we hope by the last of this month, which is August, that we will have a chance to unseat these congressmen. Mm. Because actually, this voting bill that the president passed last week, it doesn't mean anything. And I'm not looking for a voting bill in 1965 when they are not enforcing the voting bill and our voting rights with the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed us the same rights to vote from the 15th Amendment in 1870. And at that time, 1870, Mississippi was readmitted back to the Union because they promised at that time that they wouldn't do anything to disenfranchise Negroes to keep them from registering to vote. So now it's a matter of a violation of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. And what I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything? So far it hadn't worked, and I'm sick of seeing this kind of stuff on paper. We want them to do something about it because we are a part of America, because we didn't come here on our own. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human right, not for equal right.
Now, what has been happening to the fortunes of the Freedom Democratic Party? Has its membership been growing?
Well, it should be. I'm not sure, but it should be close to 78,000.
Really? And how are they organized, and where? Are they across Mississippi and Alabama only, or
well,
wider?
Actually, right now, the Mississippi Freedom Democrat Party is only in Mississippi, but they have something, I would say, similar to the Freedom Democrat Party. It's beginning to pick up in other states, you know. People as Negroes in other states, even in the North, in New York City, in Brooklyn, is beginning to run candidates, you know, in
really?
That area. That's right.
Must be scaring the daylights out of the Democratic Party to split the vote for them.
It might be, but that is what's happening
now.
That's
one way of changing the Democratic Party.
And it's one way of bringing a change, you know, for the poor people all across the country.
Before joining the Freedom Democratic Party, Mrs. Hamer had been a sharecropper on a Mississippi plantation. Her husband also worked there. He had advanced to the position of foreman. But even for a foreman, which is a high point of opportunity for a Negro there, life on a southern plantation meant long hours, low wages, humiliating conditions of work, and perhaps worst of all, no hope of being accorded fair treatment, a decent standard of living, and respect as a human being. However, Negroes were now demanding equal rights, and thousands were attempting to register to vote for the first time in their lives. Among them was Mrs. Hamer. Immediately after taking the literacy test to qualify for registration as a voter in Mississippi, she learned what it costs to challenge the system of white supremacy and white privilege in that state.
So I was forced away from the plantation because I wouldn't go back and withdraw, you know, my literacy test after I had tried to take it. I wouldn't go back, and I had to leave, and my husband was forced to stay on this plantation until after the harvest season was over, and then the man that we had worked for, he'd taken the car, and the most of the few things we had been stolen, and I've been in jail, and I've been beat.
Yeah, tell us about that. On what grounds did they jail you?
It wasn't no grounds. You know, I don't understand that until today. I had been to a voter registration workshop, you know, they were just training and teaching us how to register to pass the literacy test. And it was giving us enough training that we could tell other people, you know, how to pass the literacy test. So we had attended a workshop from the 3rd of June through the 8th. We finished the workshop on the 8th, and then we got the Continental Trailway bus to come back to Mississippi. And we got to Winona, Mississippi, I would say about 10:30 that Sunday morning on our way back to Greenwood. And that was, we had got in 25 miles of the voter registration headquarters. And the bus stopped in Winona, you know, at the bus terminal. And four people got off of the bus, you know, to use the restaurant to get food, and two people got off to use the washroom while I was still on the bus. When I looked through the glass, I saw the people rush out, and one of the girls what had gone in the washroom, she just got back on the bus, and I stepped off to see what had happened, and Miss Ponder told me that it was a state highway patrolman, and a chief of police on the inside and began to tap them on the shoulders with billy clubs and order them to get out. And I said, well, this is Mississippi. So I got back on the bus, and as soon as I was seated, I saw them when they began to put the five people, what was, you know, off the bus, but they wasn't over 6 feet from the bus, began to put them in the highway patrolman's car. And I stepped off again because I was holding one of the ladies' irons, you know, that they was arresting. And she said, get back on the bus, Miss Hamer. And then I heard somebody scream from the car that she was in and said, get that one there. And then a white man stepped out of a car and told me I was under arrest. And when he opened the door and I went to get in the car, he kicked me. And they carried me on down to the county jail where they had the other highway patrolman had carried the other five. And they, you know, when I walked in with the two white men that had carried me down, and they cursed me all the way down. They would ask me questions, and when I would try to answer, they would tell me to hush. And when I walked inside of the booking room, one of the policemen went over and jumped up on one of the Negroes' feet that was with us, and then they just began to, you know, put us in cells. And I was put in a cell with Miss Yvesta Simpson. And after I was put in this cell, I could just hear some horrible screams and horrible sounds, you know, of licks. And I saw one of the girls was 15 years old, was with us. When she passed my cell, and she was real bloody. And then they asked the little man that cleaned up the jail to go inside and mop up that blood. And then I heard some more screaming, and I heard some awful sounds. And I would hear somebody when they say, can't you say yes, sir, nigger? Can't you say yes, sir? And they would call her names that I wouldn't want to go on tape. And she said, yes, I can say yes, sir. So I said, and she said, I don't know you well enough. And I would hear when she would hit the floor again. And finally she began to pray, and she asked God to have mercy on these people because they didn't know what they was doing. And after a while, they passed my cell door with this young woman, Miss Annelle Ponder, and one of her eyes looked like blood, and her hair was standing up on her head, and her clothes had been torn from the shoulder down to the waist. And then three white men came to my cell, and one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Rouville. And he said, I'm going to check that. And he went out, and I guess he called Rouville. And they didn't like me in Rouville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, you damn right. You said, you're from Rouville, all right. And we going to make you wish you was dead. And they led me out of that cell into another cell. And he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack, and he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, do you want me to beat her with this, sir? And he said, you're damn right, because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you. And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left eye, and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being. But still, this is called a part of America.
I suppose it's a naive question, but is there no possibility of you making a civil complaint or criminal complaint or whatever it would amount to against these people for this beating?
The Justice Department brought a suit against these five law officials from Mississippi. And they had their trial in Oxford. And they had every evidence in the world if it ever was going to be any people convicted. Because we had flew to Washington, D.C. and had the pictures made, and they had the pictures today of what happened to us in that jail. The bus driver, they even had the waitresses from Winona at the bus terminal that said we hadn't done anything. We hadn't done no demonstration. The Negroes that they forced to beat me, they came and they told the truth. They told how these white men had made them drink corn whiskey before they did beat us because they figured, you know, if they didn't have something in them, that they might not do it. They told all of that, and nothing have been done. Those same men, I guess, are still wearing their guns.
It puzzles me that Negroes in the South have not set up, in a way, territories of their own with their own armed people. We've got the Deacons now in the South, this armed defense organization, so that you're outside of the control of police officials like this. Why has this not happened? Is it because the white people there are so powerful that such a rebellion has been impossible?
They are very powerful in the state of Mississippi. But some of the people, I think, is beginning to get where now they just don't care. They are beginning to see if they try to do anything for themselves, well, they'll be killed anyway.
By the police officials?
By the police officials, because it's nowhere that I would call myself going in the state of Mississippi to be protected by a police official, because they are worse than a savage.
The federal government isn't able to effectively give you security?
No, because, as you know, the three civil rights workers that was murdered in Mississippi, they said their civil rights hadn't been violated, but they are dead.
And one of their killers is still the sheriff.
That's right. In fact, the same men, Rainey and Price, was assisting the people across the street when they was having memorial service this year for Cheney, Goodman, and Michael Schroner. Mm-hmm. And Michael Schroner was a Jewish person. Mm-hmm. But he was one of the greatest men I ever met.
Mm-hmm. You knew him?
I knew him very well, and his wife, Rita. And you know, I couldn't have went there for a memorial service not and let these same two police officials guard me across the street. I wouldn't have been low enough to low their death to go across the street, let them guard me across the street. And if it hadn't been for them, they wouldn't have been dead.
What do you feel about the Deacons? This is frightening some white people, but I can't understand why they don't understand that this is a natural development.
I think it's one of the greatest things that ever happened. In fact, I admire those people. I respect those people because they are doing what I believe every Negro under the heaven feel if he doesn't have the guts to say it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Malcolm X?
Malcolm X was one of the best friends I ever had. A remarkable man. Oh, he was a great man. In fact, I had invited Malcolm X to come to Mississippi, and he was supposed to come to Mississippi on Monday and was killed that Sunday.
Now, he had belonged to the Muslim organization. Are the Muslim groups making much progress in the South? They seem mostly to be in the North.
Mostly in the North, because a whole lot of things that the Muslims stand for, I don't agree with their policies. But I did respect Malcolm X, and Malcolm X was a great man.
What can you think of that the Muslims advocate that you don't agree with? Can you think of
one of the things is setting up a separate state. You know, just give the Negroes a state. They want a state, you know, set up. It would have to be more than a state for 20 million black people in this country, but just to have so much separation, you know, that we couldn't, you know, we wouldn't have to deal with white on no terms, and just put us out, what I would say, on a deserted island. And what we had thought of with a lot of white people in the country, we'd last about 2 days.
It's sort of a reverse racism.
Yes, and just be wiped off the map. Mm-hmm. Because, you see, I take this stand that I don't see all people as bad. If we didn't have some good white people, it wouldn't be anybody standing up, you know, trying to help bring about a change and make things better, not only for the Negro, but it will benefit every human being in this country if we were just freed.
What do the people in your movement think about Dr. Martin Luther King and his approach to this whole problem?
Well, I couldn't just say in Mississippi, because people have different feelings about Dr. King.
They feel that he's accepting too slow a rate of progress?
Well, to me, it is somewhat slow, but Dr. King's organization do have some great people, like Mrs. Septima P. Clark, that wrote the book Echoes in My Soul, is a great woman, and there's quite a few other people that I admire in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and respect. But I take this stand with any person. A person that was born in the middle class that have never had to suffer, you know, he can afford to take things maybe easier than I can, and all I've ever done was suffered, you see. In fact, a person that's born in the middle class and have always had things somewhat decent, he can't make a decision for me because he actually don't know how I feel.
You know, when we mentioned middle class and middle class Negroes, I'm thinking of Leroy Jones, who's middle class Negro, but is one of the most violent of the young Negro writers and lecturers. How do your people feel about him?
Well, in Mississippi, it's not too many people know Leroy Jones, although I know Leroy Jones. But it's a wonder every Negro in the United States didn't feel exactly like Leroy Jones. It's enough to have happened to us that we should all, you know, if we wanted to feel like that. But I've never been, you know, my parent brought me up as Christian people, and I believe strongly in Christianity. And to me, if I hate you because you hate me, I'm no better than you are. And I don't hate a person because they hate me. I'll try to free that person too.
Are there any people you see among the people who are speaking for the Negro, apart from the people you've mentioned in your own organization, for instance, Louis Lomax or James Baldwin or people like that, that you regard as being significant now for the future?
Yes, I think James Baldwin is a great man. I have great respect for James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. Are you hopeful of the future for your party politically?
Yes, I'm hopeful for the future of this party because all across this country, we have young people that's very aware of what's going on in this country.
Your membership is largely young people, is it?
In the state, members of the Freedom Democrat Party will have to be 21. Mm-hmm. But we have so many other people, you see, out of the state of Mississippi is very concerned about the Mississippi Freedom Democrat Party.
Yes, but I mean, people say 21 to 30. Are they most? Is it in that age group you find most of your membership in Mississippi?
No, we have people from, I would say, 21 to 75.
Including a lot of older people then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They've given up their old attitude of accepting things.
Yes.
They have nothing to lose now.
In fact, some of the young workers there said that they had never been in a place that had as many older people working as we have in Mississippi.
Will you be standing for election at the next congressional elections?
Well, we plan to run people, you know. In fact, we have people in Sunflower County, where I live, as we hope to run for circuit clerk in Sunflower County. And we will be having people to run all over the state for state election, county, on up to the United States representative and senators, too.
I suppose money is always a problem.
Oh, money is always a problem.
More than for the other parties, though.
Yes.
Do you find you can get space in the newspapers and radio stations? And
we hope to have if we have enough money. We don't always have enough money, but we've been broke all our lives, so we go sometime without it, you know.
Mrs. Hamer, I must let you get back to your friends. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome, and thank you.
There are more U.S. reporters covering the New York Yankees than there are covering the entire continent of Africa.
And it's a shame when we as African people, we make up damn near the majority of the city, but we have to fight to get on white ruling class media.
That tells you something about the priorities of the news media in this country.
We are engaged in a war of ideas.
Warning.
You're locked in to Uhuru Radio.
Stand by.
Right here, right now.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
I and I no mix with the wicked men. I and I said trampled it.
Take a little look in it and it is.
Uhuru Radio was envisioned as a means by which our community, our people, our party, our revolutionary aspirations could contend with the ruling class in this war of ideas that contributes to maintaining the oppression of African people. Part of what African internationalism, Garveyism in the 21st century is about is ending that isolation, is bringing African people together in common struggle. And Uhuru Radio, it allows Africans in any place in the world to have access to other Africans so that reinforcement are always on the way, no matter where it is that we're struggling and no matter what may be the temporary setbacks.
Finally, the station you've been looking for.
Uhuru Radio. No degrading lyrics.
I never call you my bitch or even my boo. It's so much in the name and so much more than you.
Progressive.
And you love her like you are. So you buy.
And millions of dollars leave Sierra Leone in the form of diamonds, yet the people who mine the diamonds make 30 cents a day and a cup of rice. That's the reality all over Africa.
And revolutionary.
AFDEF is an organization of the Uhuru movement that was built in 2007 in order to organize African doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, and other skilled Africans around the world to coordinate a variety of development projects that work to transform the miserable conditions of existence that have been imposed on our people around the world.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
Uhuru Radio is developing a new programming schedule to include more music, cultural, educational, political, and multilingual programs from around the world. We are professionalizing the technical delivery of our programming, improving our sound quality and presentation. We're working to make our audio stream more accessible through mobile devices and distribution networks. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio, and the Burning Spear newspaper, the voice of the International African Revolution. We rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Become a member today. Your donation of any amount will make a difference.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
You've been listening to Africa Live on the Uhuru Radio Network. I'm Dedan Sankara. Africa Live brings you news and analysis from the African internationalist perspective. Join us again next week. Uhuru.
I want to make this a special tribute to a family that contradicts the concepts, heard the rules but wouldn't accept, and women folk raised me and I was full grown before I knew I came from a broken home. Since I lived with my grandma down south, where my uncle was leaving and my grandfather had just left for heaven, they said, and as every ologist would certainly note, I had no strong male figure, right? But Lily Scott was absolutely not your mail order, room service, typecast black grandmother. I was moved in with her, temporarily, just until things were patched, till this was patched, until that was patched, until I became at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, the patch that held Lily Scott, who held me. And like them four, I became one more. And I loved her from the absolute marrow of my bones. And we was holding on. I come from a broken home. She had more than the five senses. She knew more than books could teach, and raised everyone she touched just a little bit higher. And all around her, there was a natural sense, as though she sensed what the stars say, what the birds say, what the wind and the clouds say. A sense of soul and self, that African sense. And she raised me like she raised four of her own. And I was hurt and scared and shocked when Lily Scott left suddenly one night, and they sent a limousine from heaven to take her to God, if there is one. So I knew she had gone. And I came from a broken home. And so my life has been guided, and all the love I needed was provided. And through my mother's sacrifices, I saw where her life went. To give more than birth to me, but life to me. And this ain't one of them cliches about black women being strong, because hell, if you're weak, you're gone. But life, courage, determined to do more than just survive. And too many homes have a missing woman or man without the feeling of missing love. Maybe there are homes that are hurt, but there are no real lives that hurt will not reach, but not broken. Unless the homes of soldiers stationed overseas or lost in battles are broken. Unless the homes of firemen, policemen, construction workers, seamen, railroad men, truckers, pilots who lost their lives, but not what their lives stood for. Because men die, men lose, they are lost, and they leave. And so do women. I came from what they called a broken home, but if they ever really called at our house, they would have known how wrong they were. We were working on our lives and our homes, dealing with what we had, not what we didn't have. My life has been guided by women, but because of them, I am a man. God bless you, Mama, and thank you.
A rifle, black power, mama. Don't be no snitch, don't be no pig. Your comrades come and get you, spit you with. Just be yourself, that's enough. What you really wanna be when you grow up? Everybody wanna be a star today. So much going on in the galaxy. Jimmy said he wanna be a rapper, but have you ever thought of being an adapter? 10 years from now, will you be able to change? Will you love the game and will you think the same? Will you think I ain't fucking with no capitalism? You don't pay your taxes and you throw you in prison? What you really know about sacrifice? Giving your life, feeling the price. The price of freedom is death sometimes. Better that than dumb, deaf, and blind. Make a weak heart lose breath and mind. Huey P. Newton came just in time. So I'ma be like him, I'm getting it in until they open the pen, because we're destined to win. Hasta Victoria siempre. I am Fidel, I am Che. I am Toussaint, I'm Cinque. Us revolutionary sensei. See, I work for the people, the streets is my office. So Uncle Sam, keep your damn hands up off us. It's about to be a riot from the worker to the bosses. Obama gon' just double cross us. Fuck him, you gotta be like him, I'll be like her. The revolution gonna reoccur. We say cool, be
Jalil. Who really wanna get free for real? Be a soldier, be a rebel. Who wanna take it to another level? Be a G, be a LA. If you want some liberation, better start today.
Be free.
Yeah, I wanna be free like Frida. Yes, I said Frida. See so much freedom every time I see her. She painted pictures, she saw herself. She painted the revolution that she saw herself. And that's real, change that's real. When you think of revolution, how does it feel? Would you risk your life or kill? Or sit in a cell like Sekou and Jalil? Brought her back for the cause. I did it all for the cause. Stay in tune with the sun and the moon. Got so much love for Russell Maroon. That's Schwartz, he's the boss. 39 years behind them walls. 22 years without no calls. Banging on the system to the freedom all. To Lolita Lebron. Viva la revolución. Siempre mi corazón. It's cause of you I fight on. You got to be like you, don't be like them. Don't be no phony, don't be my friend. Just be right there when I need you. Oscar, we fight till they free you.
You gotta be like him, or be like her. The revolution gonna reoccur. Be Sekou, be Jalil. Who really wanna get free for real? Be a soldier, be a rebel. Who wanna take it to another level? Be a G, be a LA. If you want some liberation, better start the day.
If you're looking for a hero, don't look any further. You're the revolutionary, but you still can't murder. The revolution is our solution. Because the revolution has come.
Off the pig.
For our daughters and sons.
Off the pig.
Free Sekou from in jail.
Off the pig.
Or we gon' give them hell.
Off the pig. You gotta be like him, or be like her. The revolution gonna reoccur. Be Sekou, be Jalil. Who really wanna get free for real? Be a soldier, be a rebel. Who wanna take it to another level? Be a G, be a LA. If you want some liberation, better start today.
It's not for nothing.
miss a day in school. Ha. And he's an underdog. Wanna learn more and more. Oh. Call his mama tall and good. He's about to change the face of your ghetto neighborhood. Ha. Walk in school today. Saw a brother on the street. Seemed like everything was cool. Sent the brother.
To be someone to belong, to be wearing a
your mother to have her love. Don't give up now, just pray for strength now. For you I'll dedicate my song.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
There are more U.S. reporters covering the New York Yankees than there are covering the entire continent of Africa.
And it's a shame when we as African people, we make up damn near the majority of the city, but we have to fight to get on white ruling class media.
That tells you something about the priorities of the news media in this country.
We are engaged in a war of ideas.
Warning.
You're locked in to Uhuru Radio.
Stand by.
Right here, right now.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
and I no mix with the wicked men. I and I said trampled it.
Uhuru Radio was envisioned as a means by which our community, our people, our party, our revolutionary aspirations